Book 5, Chapter I, of the Piety of the Emperor Gratianus. How the Lord God is long-suffering towards those who rage against him, and chastises those who abuse his patience, is plainly taught by the acts, and by the fate of Valens. For the loving Lord uses mercy and justice, like weights and scales, whenever he sees anyone by the greatness of his errors, overstepping the bounds of loving kindness, by just punishment he hinders him from being carried to further extremes. Now Gratianus, the son of Valentinianus, and nephew of Valens, acquired the whole Roman Empire. He had already assumed the scepter of Europe, on the death of his father, in whose lifetime he had shared the throne. On the death of Valens without issue he acquired in addition Asia, and the portions of Libya. 1. Chapter 2, of the Return of the Bishops. The emperor at once gave plain indications of his adherence to true religion, and offered the first fruits of his kingdom, to the Lord of all, by publishing an edict commanding the exiled shepherds to return, and to be restored to their flocks, and ordering the sacred buildings to be delivered to congregations adopting communion with Damasus. 2. This Damasus, the successor of Liberius, in the See of Rome, was a man of most praiseworthy life, and by his own choice alike in word and deed a champion of apostolic doctrines. To put his edict in force, Gratianus sent Saper the general, a very famous character at that time, with orders to expel the preachers of the blasphemies of Arius, like wild beasts from the sacred folds, and to effect the restoration of the excellent shepherds to God's flocks. In every instance this was effected without dispute except in Antioch, the eastern capital, where a quarrel was kindled which I shall proceed to describe. Chapter 3, of the dissension caused by Paulinus, of the innovation by Apollinarius of Laodicea, and of the philosophy of Meletius. It has been already related how the defenders of the apostolic doctrines were divided into two parties, how immediately after the conspiracy formed against the great Eustathius, one section, in abhorrence of the Arian abomination, assembled together by themselves with Paulinus, for their bishop, while, after the ordination of Asuaduc, the other party separated themselves from the impious with the excellent Meletius, underwent the perils previously described, and were guided by the wise instructions which Meletius gave them. Besides these, Apollinarius of Laodicea constituted himself leader of a third party, and though he assumed a mask of piety, and appeared to defend apostolic doctrines, he was soon seen to be an open foe. About the divine nature he used unsound arguments, and originated the idea of certain degrees of dignities. He also had the hardihood to render the mystery of the Incarnation, 1, imperfect, and affirmed that the reasonable soul, which is entrusted with the guidance of the body, was deprived of the salvation effected. For according to his argument God the Word did not assume this soul, and so, neither granted it his healing gift, nor gave it a portion of his dignity. Thus the earthly body is represented as worshipped by invisible powers, while the soul which is made in the image of God has remained below invested with the dishonor of sin. 2. Many more errors did he utter in his stumbling and blinded intelligence. At one time even he was ready to confess that of the Holy Virgin the flesh had been taken, at another time he represented it to have come down from heaven with God the Word, and yet again that he had been made flesh, and took nothing from us. Other vain tales and trifles which I have thought it superfluous to repeat he mixed up with God's gospel promises. By arguments of this nature he not only filled his own friends with dangerous doctrine, but even imparted it to some among ourselves. But they did not quite put away their former unsoundness, and with it infected many of the sound. This was the origin of the growth in the Church, of the doctrine of the one nature of the flesh, and of the Godhead, of the ascription to the Godhead, of the Passion, of the Only Begotten, and of other points which have bred differences among the laity and their priests. But these belong to a later date, at the time of which I am speaking, when Saper the general had arrived and had exhibited the imperial edict. Paulinus affirmed that he sided with Damasus, and Apollinarius, concealing his unsoundness, did the same. The divine Meletius, on the other hand, made no sign, and put up with their dispute. Flavianus, of high fame for his wisdom, who was at that time still in the ranks of the presbyterate, at first said to Paulinus, in the hearing of the officer, "If, my dear friend, you accept communion with Damasus, point out to us clearly how the doctrines agree, for he, though he owns one substance of the Trinity, openly preaches three essences. 1. You, on the contrary, deny the Trinity of the essences. Show us then how these doctrines are in harmony, and receive the charge of the churches, as the edict enjoins." After so silencing Paulinus by his arguments, he turned to Apollinarius, and said, "I am astonished, my friend, to find you waging such violent war against the truth, when all the while you know quite clearly how the admirable Damasus maintains our nature to have been taken in its perfection by God the Word, but you persist in saying the contrary, for you deprive our intelligence of its salvation. If these our charges against you be false, deny now the novelty that you have originated, embrace the teaching of Damasus, and receive the charge of the holy shrines." Thus Flavianus in his great wisdom stopped their bold speech with his true reasoning. Meletius, who of all men was most meek, thus kindly and gently addressed Paulinus, "The Lord of the sheep has put the care of these sheep in my hands. You have received the charge of the rest. Our little ones are in communion with one another in the true religion. Therefore, my dear friend, let us join our flocks, let us have done with our dispute about the leading of them, and, feeding the sheep together, let us tend them in common. If the chief seat is the cause of strife, that strife I will endeavor to put away. On the chief seat I will put the holy gospel, let us take our seats on each side of it. Should I be the first to pass away, you, my friend, will hold the leadership of the flock alone. Should this be your lot before it is mine, I in my turn, so far as I am able, will take care of the sheep." So gently and kindly spoke the divine Meletius. Paulinus did not consent. The officer passed judgment on what had been said, and gave the churches to the great Meletius. Paulinus still continued at the head of the sheep who had originally seceded. Chapter 4 of Eusebius, 1, Bishop of Samosata. Apollinarius, after thus failing to get the government of the churches, continued, for the future, openly to preach his newfangled doctrine, and constituted himself leader of the heresy. He resided for the most part at Laodicea, but at Antioch he had already ordained Vitalius, a man of excellent character, brought up in the apostolic doctrines, but afterwards tainted with the heresy. Diodorus, whom I have already mentioned, too, who in the great storm had saved the ship of the church from sinking, had been appointed by the divine Meletius, bishop of Tarsus, and had received the charge of the Cilicians. The see of Apamea, 3, Meletius entrusted to John, a man of illustrious birth, more distinguished for his own high qualities than for those of his forefathers, for he was conspicuous alike for the beauty of his teaching and of his life. In the time of the tempest he piloted the assembly of his fellows, in the faith supported by the worthy Stephanus. The latter was, however, translated by the divine Meletius to carry on another contest, for on the arrival of intelligence that Germanicia had been contaminated by the Eudoxian pest, he was sent thither as a physician to ward off the disease, thoroughly trained, as he had been, in a complete heathen education as well as nurtured in the divine doctrines. He did not disappoint the expectations formed of him, for by the power of his spiritual instruction he turned the wolves into sheep. 1. On the return of the great Eusebius from exile he ordained Acacius, whose fame is great at Berea, 2, and at Hierapolis Theodotuk, 3, whose ascetic life is to this clay in all men's mouths. Eusebius, 4, was moreover appointed to the see of Chalcis and Isidorus, 5, to our own city of Cyrus, both admirable men, conspicuous for their divine zeal. Meletius has also reported to have ordained to the pastorate of Edessa, where the godly Barsus had already departed this life, Eulogius, 6, the well-known champion of apostolic doctrines, who had been sent to and anon with Protogenes. Eulogius gave Protogenes, 6, his companion in hard service, the charge of Carae, a healing physician for a sick city. Lastly, the divine Eusebius ordained Maris, bishop of Dulica, 7, a little city at that time infected with the Arian plague, with the intention of enthroning this Maris, a right worthy man, illustrious for various virtues, in the episcopal chair. The great Eusebius came to Dolica. As he was entering into the town, a woman thoroughly infected with the Arian plague let fall a tile from the roof, which crushed in his head, and so wounded him that not long after he departed to the better life. As he lay a dying, he charged the bystanders not to exact the slightest penalty from the woman who had done the deed, and bound them traitor oaths to obey him. Thus he imitated his own Lord, who of them that crucified him said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Thus, too, he followed the example of Stephanus, his fellow slave, who, after the stones had stormed upon him, cried aloud, "Lord, lay not this into their charge." 9. So died the great Eusebius, after many and various struggles. He had escaped the barbarians in Thrace, but he did not escape the violence of impious heretics, and by their means won the martyr's crown. 1. These events happened after the return of the bishops, and now Gratian learnt that Thrace was being laid waste by the barbarians, who had burned Valens, so he left Italy, and proceeded to Pannonia. Chapter 5 of the Campaign of Theodosius. Now at this time Theodosius, on account alike of the splendour of his ancestry, too, and of his own courage, was a man of high repute. For this reason, being from time to time stricken by the envy of his rivals, he was living in Spain, where he had been born and brought up. 3. The emperor, being at a loss what measures to take, now that the barbarians, puffed up by their victory, both were, and seemed well nigh invincible, formed the idea that a way out of his difficulties would be found in the appointment of Theodosius to the supreme command. He therefore lost no time in sending for him from Spain, appointing for him commander-in-chief, and dispatching him at the head of the assembled forces. Defended by his faith, Theodosius marched confidently forth. On entering Thrace, and beholding the barbarians advancing to meet him, he drew up his troops in order of battle. The two lines met, and the enemy could not stand the attack, and broke. A rout ensued, the foe taking to flight, and the conquerors pursuing at full speed. There was a great slaughter of the barbarians, for they were slain not only by Romans, but even by one another. After the greater number of them had thus fallen, and a few of those who had been able to escape pursuit had crossed the Danube, the great captain dispersed the troops which he commanded among the neighboring towns, and forthwith rode at speed to this Emperor Gratianus, himself the messenger of his own triumph. Even to the emperor himself, astounded at the event, the tidings he carried seemed incredible, while others stung with envy gave out that he had run away and lost his army. His only reply was to ask his gainsayers to send and ascertain the number of the barbarian dead, for, said he, "even from their spoils it is easy to learn their number." At these words the emperor gave way, and sent officers to investigate and report on the battle. 1. Chapter 6 of the Reign of Theodosius, and of his Dream. The great general remained, and then saw a wonderful vision clearly shewn him by the very God of the universe himself. In it he seemed to see the divine Meletius, chief of the church of the Antiochian, investing him with an imperial robe, and high covering his head with an imperial crown. The morning after the night high which he had seen the vision, he told it to one of his intimate friends, who pointed out that the dream was plain, and had nothing obscure or ambiguous about it. A few days at most had gone by when the commissioners sent to investigate the battle returned, and reported that vast multitudes of the barbarians had been shot down. Then the emperor was convinced that he had done right well in selecting Theodosius for the command, and appointed him emperor, and gave him the sovereignty of the share of Valens. Upon this Gratian departed for Italy, and dispatched Theodosius to the countries committed to his charge. No sooner had Theodosius assumed the imperial dignity than before everything else he gave heed to the harmony of the churches, and ordered the bishops of his own realm to repair with haste to Constantinople. That division of the empire was now the only region infected with the Arian plague, for the west had escaped the taint. This was due to the fact that Constantine, the eldest of Constantine's sons, and Constans, the youngest, had preserved their father's faith in its integrity, and that Valentinian, Emperor of the West, had also kept the true religion undefiled. Chapter 7 of Famous Leaders of the Arian Faction. The eastern section of the empire had received the infection from many quarters. Arius, a presbyter of Alexandria in Egypt, there begat the blasphemy. Eusebius, Patrophilus, and Aetius of Palestine, Paulinus, and Gregorius of Phoenicia, Theodotus of Laodicea, and his successor Georgius, and after him Athanasius, and Narcissus of Cilicia, had nurtured the seed so foully sown. Eusebius and Theonia of Bithynia, Menophontus of Ephesus, Theodorus of Perinthus and Marus of Charleston, and some others of Thrace famous only for their vices, had for a long time gone on watering and tending the crop of tares. These bad husbandmen were aided by the indifference of Constantius and the malignity of Valens. For these reasons only the bishops of his own empire were summoned by the emperor to meet at Constantinople. They arrived, being in all 150 in number, and Theodosius forbade anyone to tell him which was the great Meletius, for he wished the bishop to be recognized by his dream. The whole company of the bishops entered the imperial palace, and then without any notice of all the rest, Theodosius ran up to the great Meletius, and, like a boy who loves his father, stood for a long space gazing on him with filial joy, then flung his arms around him, and covered eyes and lips and breast and head, and the hand that had given him the crown, with kisses. Then he told him of his dream. All the rest of the bishops were then courteously welcomed, and all were bidden to deliberate as became fathers on the subjects laid before them. Chapter 8. The Council Assembled at Constantinople. At this time the recent feeder of the flock at Nazianzus, 1, was living at Constantinople, 1, continually withstanding the blasphemies of the Arians, watering the holy people with the teaching of the gospel, catching wanderers outside the flock, and removing them from poisonous pasture. So that flock once small he made a great one. When the divine Meletius saw him, knowing, as he did full well, the object which the makers of the canon, 2, had before them, when, with a view of preventing the possibility of ambitious efforts, they forbade the translation of bishops, he confirmed Gregory in the episcopate of Constantinople, 3. Shortly afterwards the divine Meletius passed away to the life that knows no pain, crowned by the praises of the funeral eloquence of all the great orators. Timotheus, bishop of Alexandria, who had followed Peter, the successor of Athanasius, in the patriarchate, ordained in place of the admirable Gregorius Maximus, a cynic, who bad, but recently suffered his cynic's hair to be shorn, and had been carried away by the flimsy rhetoric of Apollinarius. But this absurdity was beyond the endurance of the assembled bishops, admirable men, and full of divine zeal and wisdom, such as Heladius, successor of the great Basil, Gregorius, and Peter, brothers of Basil, and Amphilochius from Lycaonia, Optimus from Pisidia, Diodorus from Cilicia, 4. The council was also attended by Pelagius of Laodicea, 1, Eulogius of Edessa, 2, Acacius, 3, our own Isidorus, 4, Cyril of Jerusalem, Galasius of Caesarea in Palestine, 5, who was renowned alike for lore and life, and many other athletes of virtue. All these then whom I have named separated themselves from the Egyptians, and celebrated divine service with the great Gregory. But he himself implored them, assembled as they were, to promote harmony, to subordinate all question of wrong to an individual to the promotion of agreement with one another. For, said he, I shall be released from many cares, and once more lead the quiet life I hold so dear, while you, after your long and painful warfare, will obtain the longed-for peace. What can be more absurd than for men, who have just escaped the weapons of their enemies, to waste their own strength in wounding one another? By so doing we shall be a laughingstock to our opponents. Find then some worthy man of sense, able to sustain heavy responsibilities, and discharge them well, and make him bishop. The excellent pastors moved by these counsels appointed as bishop of that mighty city a man of noble birth, and distinguished for every kind of virtue as well as for the splendour of his ancestry, by name Nectarius. Maximus, as having participated in the insanity of Apollinarius, they stripped of his episcopal rank, and rejected. They next enacted canons concerning the good government of the Church, and published a confirmation of the faith set forth at Nicaea. Then they returned each to his own country. Next summer the greater number of them assembled again in the same city, summoned once more by the needs of the Church, and received a synodical letter from the bishops of the West inviting them to come to Rome, where a great synod was being assembled. They begged, however, to be excused from traveling thus far abroad. Their doing so, they said, would be useless. They wrote, however, both to point out the storm which had risen against the churches, and to hint at the carelessness with which the Western bishops had treated it. They also included in their letter a summary of the apostolic doctrine, but the boldness and wisdom of their expressions will be more clearly shown by the letter itself. Chapter 9. Synodical Letter from the Council at Constantinople. To the Right Honorable Lords, our Right Reverend Brethren and Colleagues Damasus, Ambrosius, Britain, Valerianus, Alias, Ahemius, Basilius, and the rest of the holy bishops assembled in the great city of Rome, the Holy Synod of the Orthodox bishops assembled at the great city of Constantinople, sends greeting in the Lord. To recount all the sufferings inflicted on us by the power of the Arians, and to attempt to give information to your reverences, as though you were not already well acquainted with them, might seem superfluous, for we do not suppose your piety to hold what is befalling us as of such secondary importance as that you stand in any need of information on matters which cannot but evoke your sympathy. Nor indeed were the storms which beset us such as to escape notice from their insignificance. Our persecutions are but of yesterday. The sound of them still rings in the ears alike of those who suffered them, and of those whose love made the sufferers pain their own. It was but today or two ago, if I may so say, that some released from chains in foreign lands returned to their own churches through manifold afflictions. Of others, who had died in exile, the relics were brought home. Others again, even after their return from exile, found the passion of the heretic still at boiling heat, and, slain by them with stones as was the blessed Stephen, met with a sadder fate in their own than in a stranger's land. Others, worn away with various cruelties, still bear in their bodies the scars of their wounds, and the marks of Christ. 1. Who could tell the tale of fines, of disfranchisements, of individual confiscations, of intrigues, of outrages, of prisons? In truth, all kinds of tribulation were wrought out beyond number in us, perhaps, because we were paying the penalty of sins, perhaps, because the merciful God was trying us by means of the multitude of our sufferings. For these all thanks to God, who by means of such afflictions trained his servants, and, according to the multitude of his mercies, brought us again to refreshment. We indeed needed long leisure, time, and toil to restore the church once more, that so, like physicians healing the body after long sickness, and expelling its disease by gradual treatment, we might bring her back to her ancient health of true religion. It is true that on the whole we seem to have been delivered from the violence of our persecutions, and to be just now recovering the churches which have for a long time been the prey of the heretics. But wolves are troublesome to us, who, though they have been driven from the byre, yet harry the flocks up and down the glades, daring to hold rival assemblies, stirring seditions among the people, and shrinking from nothing which can do damage to the churches. So, as we have already said, we needs must labor all the longer. Since, however, you showed your brotherly love to us by inviting us, as though we were your own members, by the letters of our most religious emperor, to the synod which you are gathering by divine permission at Rome, to the end that since we alone were then condemned to suffer persecution, you should not now, when our emperors are at one with us as to true religion, reign apart from us, but that we, to use the apostle's phrase, 1, should reign with you. Our prayer was, if it were possible, all in company to leave our churches, and rather gratify our longing to see you than consult their needs. For who will give us wings as of a dove, and we will fly, and be at rest too, but the score seemed likely to leave the churches, who were just recovering, quite undefended, and the undertaking was to most of us impossible, for, in accordance with the letters sent a year ago from Your Holiness, after the Synod at Aquileia, to the most pious Emperor Theodosius, we had journeyed to Constantinople, equipped only for traveling so far as Constantinople, and bringing the consent of the bishops remaining in the provinces for this synod alone. We had been in no expectation of any longer journey, nor had heard a word about it before our arrival at Constantinople. In addition to all this, and on account of the narrow limits of the appointed time which allowed of no preparation for a longer journey, nor of communicating with the bishops of our communion in the provinces, and of obtaining their consent, the journey to Rome was for the majority impossible. We have therefore adopted the next best course open to us under the circumstances, both for the better administration of the Church, and for manifesting our love towards you, by strongly urging our most venerated and honored colleagues and brother bishops Kyriakos, Eusebius, and Priscianus, to consent to travel to you. Through them we wish to make it plain that our disposition is all for peace with unity for its sole object, and that we are full of zeal for the right faith. For we, whether we suffered persecutions, or afflictions, or the threats of emperors, or the cruelties of princes, or any other trial at the hands of heretics, have undergone all for the sake of the evangelic faith, ratified by the 318 fathers at Nicaea and Bithynia. This is the faith which ought to be sufficient for you, for us, for all who rest not the word of the true faith, for it is the ancient faith, it is the faith of our baptism, it is the faith that teaches us to believe in the name of the Father, of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. According to this faith there is one Godhead, power, and substance, of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, the dignity being equal, and the majesty being equal in three perfect essences, one, and three perfect persons, two. Thus, there is neither room for the heresy of Sabellius, by the confusion of the essences or destruction of the individualities, thus the blasphemy of the Eunomians, of the Arians, and of the Pneumatomachy is nullified, which divides the substance, the nature and the Godhead, and superinduces on the uncreated consubstantial and coeternal Trinity a nature posterior, created, and of a different substance. We moreover preserve unperverted the doctrine of the incarnation of the Lord, holding the tradition that the dispensation of the flesh is neither soulless nor mindless nor imperfect, and knowing full well that God's word was perfect before the ages, and became perfect then in the last days for our salvation. Let this suffice for a summary of the doctrine which is fearlessly and frankly preached by us, and concerning which you will be able to be still further satisfied if you will deign to read the report of the Synod of Antioch, and also that issued last year by the Ecumenical Council held at Constantinople, in which we have set forth our confession of the faith at greater length, and have appended an anathema against the heresies which innovators have recently inscribed. Now as to the particular administration of individual churches, an ancient custom, as you know, has obtained, confirmed by the enactment of the Holy Fathers at Nicaea, that, in every province, the bishops of the province, and, with their consent, the neighboring bishops with them, should perform ordinations as expediency may require. In conforming with these customs, note that other churches have been administered by us and the priests of the most famous churches publicly appointed, accordingly over the new made, if the expression be allowable, church at Constantinople, which, as though from a lion's mouth, we have lately snatched by God's mercy from the blasphemy of the heretics, we have ordained bishop the right reverend and most religious Nectarius, in the presence of the Ecumenical Council, with common consent, before the most religious Emperor Theodosius, and with the assent of all the clergy, and of the whole city, and over the most ancient and truly apostolic church in Syria, where first the noble name of Christians, 1, was given them, the bishops of the province, and of the eastern diocese, 2, have met together, and canonically ordained bishop the right reverend and most religious Flavianus, with the consent of all the church, who, as though with one voice joined in expressing their respect for him, this rightful ordination also received the sanction of the General Council of the Church at Jerusalem, mother of all the churches, we make known that the Right Reverend and Most Religious Cyril is bishop, who was some time ago canonically ordained by the bishops of the province, and has in several places fought a good fight against the Arians. We beseech your reverence to rejoice at what has thus been rightly and canonically settled by us, by the intervention of spiritual love, and by the influence of the fear of the Lord, compelling the feelings of then, and making the edification of churches of more importance than individual grace or favor. Thus, since among us there is agreement in the faith and Christian charity has been established, we shall cease to use the phrase condemned by the apostles, I am of Paul and I of Apollos and I of Cephas, 3, and all appearing as Christ's, who in us is not divided. By God's grace we will keep the body of the church unrent, and will boldly stand at the judgment seat of the Lord. These things they wrote against the madness of Arius, Aetius, and Oinominus, and moreover against Sabellius, Photinus, Marcellus, Paul of Samosata, and Macedonius. Similarly they openly condemned the innovation of Apollinarius, in the phrase, and we preserve the doctrine of the incarnation of the Lord, holding the tradition, that the dispensation of the flesh is neither soulless, nor mindless, nor imperfect,